Thank you so much for that kind introduction. And I want to say that I am really happy to be here, as well as to say that, indeed, I do feel very much at home now in the University of Hong Kong, having been here upon your invitation, teaching in the Department of Computer Science, even though my home department tends to be business school. So I'm at the intersection of corporate strategy, entrepreneurship, and technology. So this is a very interesting place to be right now. I just want to go ahead and just mention that you might be surprised at the title of my talk. I call it Dynamic Digital Capabilities. And I do that to just remind a number of people in the corporate strategy and the strategic management field, which is the area that I come out of, and have one of the most cited papers in the strategic management field in the Strategic Management Journal, that things have changed dramatically. When we first wrote that paper, we were talking about dynamic capabilities as being how did large corporations deal with difficult and volatile environments? And this was the environments of something like the semiconductor industry, or what we called high tech at that time. And now, we are looking at a whole new frontier that I'm going to tell you about, which is dynamic digital capabilities. And we'll mention within this talk why this is so different, why it is that economists, trade theorists, corporate strategic theorists are all doing research in this area, is because we've reached a very different parallel universe. There's very different economics that go behind a digital economy and a smartphone economy than what we grew up with in terms of manufacturing and physical goods. So without further ado, I'll just mention, as Paul has, that we're going to look at what does it mean to have competitive advantage in a digital economy, and how do you get there, especially for the many Fortune 500s and International 100 companies that are feeling left behind by the digital transformation and by the new economy. And so we're going to look at the case of Pokemon Go, something that all of you, it seems, have experienced. And we're going to look at it from the viewpoint and also the perspective of three players. Niantic Labs, which you may not have heard the name of because it's a pretty new company, only 2 years old, is the startup that was a Google spin-off that actually created the Pokemon Go game. However, it would not have existed without Google, because it was a Google Earth spin-off, and Google was the company that made it possible for them to actually execute on their plan. And then we'll talk about Nintendo. So here we have a multinational alliance that has spawned this wonderful phenomenon that's become a cultural and social phenomenon. And Nintendo is a Japanese company, a company that many people believed, and their stock seemed to indicate, was going downhill, kind of like the Nokia of the game and video game industry. They had a couple of really good runs, but everyone was wondering if they could make the huge jump to the digital world, since they had been known mostly for their standalone consoles. And then they wondered if they could ever get to mobile games. The smartphone, the largest marketplace, they weren't involved with, except by the acquisition, of course, of a mobile game producer. So, for those of you who play Pokemon, I hope you appreciate my first page. Hello, there. I am Professor, not Ash or Oak, Professor Schumann. Why does Folkemango matter to strategy? What can we learn from this interesting multinational strategic alliance that created this phenomenon? How can combinatorial, digital, and exponential innovation, three kinds of innovation we believe are at work here, explain how a free mobile game makes $10 million a day and can be rolled out in 90-plus countries with 100 million downloads in less than 1 month? And do people know about how much they've gotten to now? Something like 500 or 600 million downloads in 2 months. That is phenomenal. It totally redefines our idea of competitive advantage in the augmented reality field. We've never seen anything this fast. So, without further ado, why does Pokemon matter to a strategist or to a strategy researcher? I think that the headlines tell the story. Pokemon Go revenue skyrockets to more than $440 million since its release. How can a free-to-play game make $440 million? So that would be something we'll ask. Pokemon Go startup is worth $3.65 billion. So in terms of market valuation, it went from a company that 2 years ago had 20 million in funding, and now it's a unicorn. So how did it get there? Nintendo's market cap doubled to 42 billion since Pokemon Go launch, but indeed it did go down after that. On the other hand, have you seen any other company that has gone from market cap of doubling from one product launch? Here's how Apple could generate $3 billion on Pokemon Go. So how does Apple get $3 billion? It's not one of these players. How Pokemon is driving insane amounts of sales at small local businesses. Here's the most interesting part of the story. The real beneficiaries of this have been all of these local businesses that have received an amazing amount of foot traffic and new customers that they've never had before. So almost as much $440 million of that was spent by players. I imagine you have the experience. You've gone walking and you've met your friends, maybe at a location where they've seen a character, and you've bought a coffee, or you've maybe bought some baked goods, or you've had lunch in that location. These were all things that you might not have done. You might have never have discovered that particular area of town unless you were looking for these characters. So imagine that happening for local businesses in 90 plus countries. That what that was experiencing in each city was in rural areas, was in locations that, you know, didn't know about advertising, but all of a sudden found themselves with people coming and trying their goods and maybe coming back on a regular basis to train with their friends. Pokemon Go players have walked far enough to reach the sun from Neptune. If you guys, especially the ones who have a number of Pokemon, you've done a lot of walking, haven't you? And maybe more walking than you have in a long time. Because you need to walk to be able to hatch eggs, right? And you often walk with friends. Families walk together. Can anyone guess how many miles? 4.6 billion kilometers have been walked, and people think that this is a public health phenomenon. That all of a sudden, all these people are just getting out of their, on their off from their desks and in the evening, walking streets, walking to parks, meeting friends in different places, exploring new areas where they think they might be able to find Pokemon characters. This is great for communities, isn't it? And Pokemon Go hits 500 million downloads with billions of miles walked. Okay? Just a couple of the headlines that you have to look at and wonder, how is this possible? So why does it matter to strategy that all these things happen, besides raising the bar and saying, do we have to totally redefine competitive advantage and high performance? I remember Andy Grove saying, sometimes when you have a 10x force in the marketplace, and here's a 100x performance difference, order of magnitude differences in speed, in time, in the amount of anything that's happened around this, is that so game-changing and landscape-changing that it's like a hurricane or some natural disaster where the industry landscape will never be the same again? And so that's part of the issue, is this is just yet another example of digital network effects that is just blowing away this industry and having it influence the real world of local businesses and museums and parks. So we're going to talk about it with these terms. We're going to call it a positive sum game. We're going to talk about it as economic, financial, public, and social rewards. We're going to talk about it in terms of digital transformation of industries and companies. We're going to talk about the speed, how quickly this all happened. And finally, we're going to talk about this as an amazing situation where a startup wasn't just a gap filler, wasn't just something that a large company was going to acquire. They were the conductor of the orchestra. They were the ones who actually orchestrated the innovation of two major giants in two different locations and countries. So very interesting number of firsts that we're going to explore. So what is a positive sum game? I think that it's funny, most of us don't have a lot of experience with positive sum games. If we're in business, we're used to what's called a zero sum game. All of those pies that you see that are divided up into market share, those are all zero sum games. You have one pie, it's a certain size, and there are winners and losers, right? If somebody gains market share, somebody has to lose market share, right? So there's only a fixed size of the pie in most marketplaces and industries. So in an industry, you'll end up with everyone being called a competitive rival. And what you're trying to do is do better than everybody else in your industry that is making something that is similar to your product or service. Probably the only place that in the past we used to see positive sum games is where? Is actually in trade, in international trade theory, where when two groups trade together, both of their GDPs can go up. Okay? And sometimes we see it as innovation. Sometimes something very innovative will create new rewards that weren't there before. So positive sum is when economic, financial, or social rewards are created as a result of playing the game. Is this the case with Pokemon Go? We've certainly seen it in another place. We've seen it where? In the App Store for Apple. That's where we've seen positive sum games in digital theory, because they actually created this whole new marketplace where developers who made apps and were on the App Store could earn money from their apps and pay 30% of their of the money they made, the revenue,
to Apple for being on. However, what did that mean? That actually turned out to be millions of dollars and billions of dollars. If you look at the real numbers for Apple, it's something like $60 billion that they created. $60 billion. But remember, how much of that 30% actually went to Apple? So part of the reason it's becoming such a one of the largest companies in terms of revenues and dollars is because it figured out that actually owning a digital platform, like, or mobile platform, like the iPhone, was an incredibly valuable and profitable venture. Because then anyone who used your platform and brought new benefits to consumers, right, also paid you 30% of what they got.
I thought
so
it was 20% or something.
30.
So 30?
Yeah, it's 30. 20. I think it's 30. Yeah, and Android was also. But what's very interesting is part of the reason that Apple makes more on its App Store than Android does is not because the percentage is different, but actually allow a larger number for apps. Do you know that one of the largest revenue apps is something like $2,000? Can you imagine paying $1,000 for an app? While as Google and Android, the Google Play Store, only allows you to sell apps up to $200. So if we were to look at the economic, financial, public, and social rewards that were created, we'd see this picture. And it's a pretty interesting picture. We'd see that private sector, so the Pokemon innovators and the mobile cloud platform, Google, and of course iOS, Apple, made $440 million or something like $10 million a day. Their valuation went up by a huge amount. And so all of these numbers are millions and billions, right? That's in the private sector. But at the same time, the private sector that was benefiting was the local businesses that got all these new customers. So global, along with local businesses in 90 plus countries, we'll talk about, they also have deals with McDonald's, deals with Starbucks, so large corporate grads. And in the public sector, we could say that there's a public social reward that these players are now getting out and socializing. They're walking. They're walking 4.6 billion kilometers, 500 million users, because, as you know, it turns out that to be able to hatch these eggs and get these lucky eggs to become the Pokemon monsters that you want, you need to actually walk. So you end up walking 2.2 miles or 5 kilometers, I guess. Is that the right amount to hatch an egg? And then in terms of the public sector, people may not realize, but a number of these sites that came from the original Ingress game actually are in public parks, artwork, lakes, museums, right? So this one was a very funny one where I guess a museum, the Carnegie Museum, did a little promotion where they actually let everybody know. They said, these Pokemon monsters are actually munching on the paintings. Please come and capture them and catch them and take them away. Okay, so we get to talk about Pokemon Go and how it transformed a beloved but tired brand, right? How many of you actually had played or knew about Pokemon from earlier on, from the trading cards? Most people? No. So you see, that's already a fascinating thing. Many, many young people have actually remembered that, and I remember as a parent, that my kids played with Pokemon trading cards. So there's this huge network or installed base where people build up these skills, didn't they? And know a lot about these different characters. What's some of the other reasons they know about these characters? Was it only the trading card? No. It was a cross-network effect, right? It turns out that there was a TV program. And so it was one of the first successes for Pokemon, where they were able to transfer a well-known character that was extremely popular in Japan to the States. This is one of the first really, really popular transfers, and they did that by, they didn't believe it was going to work, of course, because, you know, even at that time, the people in the States said, well, but, you know, U.S. kids, American kids want to shoot them up. It's not violent. Nintendo is a company that wants to, you know, actually do wholesome family kinds of games. And, you know, the American distributor says, I don't know if that will work in the States. Kids want to have things that they shoot and, you know, be violent. And it was one of the first games that actually translated correctly and with a big success from Japan. One of the things that is interesting about this partnership is the actual day-to-day that happened in the 2 years where they created this first out product that then rolled out to 92 countries in less than 2 months. So what happens is, and we know a little bit more about this history because John Hanke, the CEO and founder of Niantic Labs, the group that actually put all of this together and orchestrated this, is a Haas MBA of the years when I taught there. And so we have two cases written about how he created Ingress, because Ingress, his first company, was actually funded by the university in the Berkeley incubator. And I should have just had a picture. He had the incubator is right next to this wonderful outdoor cafe, Cafe Strada, that I used to consider my, you know, sort of office away from the business school, because it's just a short walk away. So he actually had a company when he started that got funded by the Berkeley incubator, and it actually got acquired by Google. That's how he ended up in Google. And then his company became the basis for Google Earth. So he spent the next 10 years creating Google Earth for Google. Then when they became Alphabet, they decided that that wasn't as core anymore, and he was already doing Ingress as a experiment, and decided that he was going to go off to spin off from Google. And that was the point in time at that 2 years ago where he said, but what is going to be our product? And we're spinning off from Google. Ingress is doing okay. What should we do? Does anyone remember the Google April Fool's joke? No? So what happened, as some people remember, in April Fool's there was an engineer, a Japanese engineer, in Google, who said, wouldn't it be funny to pretend that there are actually, you know, Pokemon characters that existed within Google Maps, and you could find them. And so they contacted Nintendo and Pokemon and said, we're thinking of doing this joke, and we'll actually make it a real game so that people can play it. And they had, in the first hour or two, 22,000 people downloaded to play. So it became very clear that there was a very big interest in some game that had online Pokemon characters. But we have the next part of the story, which is that John Hanke was able to use combinatorial innovation, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But he actually met Nintendo Pokemon the CEO of Pokemon Company, which is part of Nintendo. And guess what? The CEO turned out to be an experienced and avid Ingress player.
So actually, when John Hankey went and said, you know, here's the founder of the Ingres game, we're thinking of doing something like the Ingres game, but having Pokemon characters in it, he said, this is great. We've got to do this. And he went personally to his parent, Nintendo, and opened the doors to their being able to work together. And then, of course, it was very helpful to have Google and Sundar in the mix as well. Why do you think would it be helpful to have, besides Google Earth Experience? Because you needed the cloud, right? You needed someone to be able to actually create the link with your camera and the maps and make this possible in 92 countries. So you needed all their servers. You needed all the cloud enablement that Google was trying to do. And that turned out to be an amazing sort of connection, because what happened, and this is in an interview that they've had on TechCrunch, John Hankey says, you know what happened? We thought we had it under control because we did a soft launch in Australia. And everything seemed to be working. So we said, okay, let's go live in the States. And in 1 hour, he said, of opening up in the States, they had blown through their worldwide capacity for the year. So it took up so quickly that he had to email immediately Sundar Pichai, the CEO, and say, we're going to be down in 1 hour's time because we're out of capacity already. And so Sundar, knowing John and knowing the situation, actually released capacity immediately. And that's how they managed to take the kind of the exponential growth that they had and not be limited by the storage and by the cloud. So within 1 hour, they had run through what they had forecast worldwide for the entire year. So it really was much faster than they expected. So what is combinatorial innovation? I use this as a simple explanation, is one that some of my students will have heard before, is I call it digital transformation and the global digital stone soup, where millions of cooks co-create value. Now, I'll start by saying the easy way to think of this is, how many of you have heard of the story of stone soup? No? Okay, yes, you have. Good. Because stone soup was this well-known fable in many, many countries, right? That there was a hungry village, not a single person had enough to eat. They only had half a carrot, a celery piece, this and that and the other thing. But an enterprising organizer said, okay, I'm going to put a huge pot of hot water and put it in the middle of the village and put a fire under it, and I'm going to get a stone, and I'm going to put it in the stone and ask everyone to contribute to stone soup, right? But if everybody lines up and puts their scrap into the cauldron, when you're done, you actually have a soup that might feed a whole village. Okay? However, that stone soup is limited, because after the villagers have taken each of their bowls of soup out of it, there's nothing more left. Can't do that tomorrow. The whole difference of digital economics and the digital stone soup is all the bits that are uploaded, all the bits that go onto the web, can be costlessly copied, costlessly distributed, somewhat costlessly sliced and diced in different ways, and then resold in many different ways to as many people as you want. It's not like a car. If I build a car and I take a certain number of parts and it costs me a certain, or I take an iPhone and I build the 451 parts in it and I sell it to someone, I can only sell it once, right? I can't sell it multiple times. It's gone.
I make my profit per unit, and then it's done, right? But a digital good, imagine what Pokemon Go has done that's so brilliant. Every one of you who plays Pokemon Go, each of you have your own Pokédex, don't you? Each of you can have your own list of Pokemon characters that you have personally caught, right? But the fact that you have a Charizard doesn't take away, and even you might be very proud to tell someone where you got your character. If this was a Cabbage Patch doll or a physical stuffed animal, would you tell anyone where you got it? Because no. Because then maybe you run out, right? Then it's depleted and you feel that there's a reason that you have to keep the information to yourself because it's scarce. It's a zero-sum game, right? If I get one or I find one, that takes away one of the units that you can have. But in the digital world, it doesn't. They're more than enough for everyone. So that you feel like you can cooperate. You can collaborate with any of these other folks who probably after class will ask you where you found them in Hong Kong. So that they can do better on their Pokemon character and Pokédex as well. But that's where the digital transformation comes in. Digital goods can be redone. You can every half hour spawn Pokemon characters in a certain location and get more and more people excited about playing. You are not limited by the physical world and by inventory. You can make as much as you need and as much as anyone wants. Okay? So that's part of what's going on, where everyone can add to the pot and co-create, and when you take something away for yourself, it doesn't affect the others. So that's where the speed comes in, is that part of what this was, that we could communicate very quickly our excitement about how great this was. So we can have virally, we could have word of mouth, but even more importantly than that, we actually could get people excited about getting, telling people socially or in their networks about this fun game. So it became the social network that only increased the number of people that wanted to play and the excitement about the game. So, here's where we say the startup as an innovation orchestrator, why this was so important. We actually ended up in a situation where we had John Hankey as the conductor. He was able to get Google to enable this on Android, but also to create the cloud enablement so that everyone could play in 92 different countries, right? We also see that partly the Pokemon company and Nintendo was able to create the game mechanics that kept people interested and kept people doing things with the game. Now, I know all of you are probably waiting till more of the features come out, especially people who know about trading cards plus the different battles that you can do. But this is where all of those things, it's been said, are going to come out in the next, probably around the Christmas season. How many people actually already did the Halloween special? Or maybe that wasn't available everywhere. Was it available here? Yeah, that you could get double candy, Pokemon candies if you had a buddy, and then you could get four. So you could really advance quickly. And so that got a lot of people that might have felt that they had just, gotten stopped on their Pokemon trail, that they could start up again. But my understanding is the next step will be an entire social kind of event like Ingress, where, you know, you will be only able to bring 6 or 7 Pokemon characters to each gym. Then you'll have all these fascinating combinations because people will be in different teams. They'll have, some of them will have badges, some of them will have levels. It'll become an entirely complicated game. Now, I do believe that that's going to be incredibly sticky. That what happened with the Pokemon cards was that people like playing it. I mean, it's much more, in some ways, when I hear about what it's like, it's more complicated than Bridge. And it's much more social because you can do it in larger groups. So it really has a potential of being able to be extremely sticky and a continuing and very long-lasting kind of phenomenon. And then, of course, we know that we can use Pokemon to boost local businesses. So all of those things put together ended up making Niantic Labs one of the increasingly crowded unicorn club. So unicorns, as you know, are these $1 billion plus private companies. And we're now seeing that there are companies that are getting to be $1 billion plus in revenue before they go public, right? So those are the ones we call unicorns. And there are lots of them. Many of them, of course, in the on-demand world. So in our class, and you know, I'll expose, this is just a fun way of showing you, I used to teach entrepreneurship when we would take 3 weeks or more to write a business plan. And you know, we carefully do the marketplace, the competition, this and that and the other thing. Now, just like speeding up everything else, we do a one-page business model canvas. And on one page, you can see what's going on in all of the key areas, but also see how they actually relate to each other. So even though many people will do this and put stickies and put words in it, I'm going to do this with pictures so that it's a lot easier to look at. And we're going to fill this out just with a couple of clicks of our clicker. So the value proposition is that we have people who have this free-to-play downloaded app, right? So free-to-play, you can download it, 500 million people have downloaded. So that's the channel, okay? The channel is a smartphone. The customer relationship is one of gamification. We want to catch them all. We want to have fun. And the customer segments are people who are walking to get more Pokemon characters, catch them all, and also to incubate their eggs. But meanwhile, as the customers are those, another customer is clearly the small businesses that are all benefiting from this walking about. So it's actually being used to not only get people to walk, to have fun, but also to boost local businesses. So that's where the revenue comes in. Where's the revenue? It turns out that they're all in-app purchases, what we call virtual goods purchases. So it turns out that you can play this game and have a great time just doing everything you want to with this free app. However, if you're a little bit impatient and you want to accelerate your journey to, you know, 130, 140 Pokemon characters, you could buy a couple of extra incubators, right? You could buy a couple of extra incense, right, to lure some of these around. So you can speed up your process with small purchases. You know, maybe $10 here, $10 there, something that most people would not think twice about doing, and especially if you had a lucky egg and you really thought it might be something you needed, you know, $10 two lattes, you know, seems pretty reasonable, right? And it's so easy.
That's Hong Kong or U.S.?
Oh, U.S. dollars.
$10 U.S., you say that's little money?
Really?
Yeah, for a game.
Oh, no. I mean, if you're going to walk 2 or 4 miles and you have a few more incubators and you could get, you know, one of the rare Pokemon, do you think it's worth it? Yeah, definitely. Oh, so maybe it varies.
It's $8.
Okay, yeah. So it's like
$1.
So $1.
Like $10 you get hundreds of eggs.
Okay. Oh wow. So they probably do it in currency that makes sense for the difference, because in the States they tend to be $10 to get like 4 incubators and a little bit of coins. So they probably
made
$10.
You see the difference between a wealthy student and a poor professor?
We do see the difference. Now, we're talking about priorities here. I mean, the truth of the matter is, though, right? The difference is, would I spend that for a latte or 2 lattes? Or would I spend it for my health club? Maybe not. I'd rather spend it on my Pokemon characters. That's why you're here. You're not in the health club or running instead. So, the other thing is that actually businesses can do that as well. The very clever thing they did, I don't know what it costs in Hong Kong, but in the States, for about $10 a day, so for $2 an hour, you could have lures that you place at your store that actually lure Pokemon characters to your area so that people congregate in your area. So imagine for $2, you could get, if you got 5 new customers who passed by a day, or an hour, that's an amazing return, right? Customer acquisition costs actually turn out to be much, much more than $2 an hour. So depending on your timing, that makes a lot of sense. And all of that, basically enough, whether poor professors or wealthy students, provide for a large part of that $440 million and $10 million a day. Because 90 countries, 600 million people. How many people are willing to spend whatever, the $1, to get ahead of the game? Clearly a lot. So, the other thing is that businesses, as I mentioned, also pay for lures. So that is another revenue stream that I put as a dollar. So these are in-app purchases. So you go to your Pokestore and great, because of microtransactions, it's easy, right? So, what else is going on? We know on the cost side that there are key partners. We needed Google for the web and for the cloud enablement. We needed it for the Google Earth and the maps, right? So that's where that comes in. We know we needed Nintendo. We know we needed Pokemon, and Pokemon, I think, is the underestimated group, because the game mechanics, as you know, are critical to whether people like games and whether they keep playing. And they really hit on the most amazing game mechanics for Pokemon trading cards, and they're now just putting that online in a very, very, very well thought out way. Key activities is the orchestration, the integration, the virtual or augmented reality, using the camera along with the digital characters, Google Maps, and the cloud. You put those all together, if you think of it, none of them are huge technological leaps, are they? They're just putting them together. Well-known brand, good game mechanics, web enablement, maps that you have already, camera that you have in your phone already, put those together and you get this amazing business. So the orchestration and the integration and the thinking of this was really the key. Key resources, they needed to know where to put the the Pokemon characters. So they got that out of the previous game, Ingress. The cloud. So there's some cost structure, there's some IT infrastructure for sure, right? They had to pay for all those things. They had to license the characters, right? So that's a place. But the other thing they did was have big corporate partners like McDonald's and Starbucks. So that in Japan, can you imagine at the Japanese opening of Pokemon Go, they had 3,600 McDonald's chain stores that had special Pokemon that people knew that they could get there. They just had just the pictures. They had millions of people just crowding into these different locations to see if they could get these special or rare Pokemon characters at the at McDonald's. And so that also added a little treasure trove, 3,600 stores at one time. So I think this is an easy way, as you see, to kind of exhibit what we've said today in all these different areas and to see how everything fit together, how it all flowed and could be put together to make a really astounding success. Yeah, so on takeaways, I hope you remember that we've done some things about saying that there are five interesting areas that Pokemon Go matters to strategy and innovation, that we can learn a lot from the idea of a small company being the orchestrator for two larger companies, including one of them, who really needed help in getting to a smartphone and mobile world. Combinatorial, we talked about in terms of the digital transformation. Exponential is just the speed at which all of this happened because you were able to put together all these networks that already existed and leverage them very effectively. So we now know a little bit about how a free mobile game can make $10 million a day, can roll out in 90 plus countries and have 100 million downloads in 1 month. So I'm going to stop and ask some questions. I'll also show a really quick thing just to tell you that this has some real importance. This is actually, I've written a paper on the network effects of Pokemon Go for the network economics. And so actually for researchers, there's some very interesting aspects of this. Global economics really are looking at how you can create digital goods that cross different borders and create positive sum gains. Now, the idea that there are all these social rewards that we used to call consumer surplus that we can now measure very accurately. We can measure exactly how many miles were walked by the people doing Pokemon Go games. And so that has a lot to say about what we can do about the knowledge economy, measuring it, macroeconomics, and multinational strategy. This is clearly an example, and at least one process, in which digital transformation has made a difference to industries and industrial economics. It's clearly a corporate strategic and business model innovation story. The speed has a lot to say about what's going on in the digital economy and also about the volatility of our financial markets. When things like this happen and can happen in less than a month or 2 months' time, clearly your stock market can't react fast enough. And then this idea that a startup might be the way to orchestrate innovation has a lot to do with how entrepreneurship and how you might be able to build digital capabilities in the future to have large companies, that in the past have worried about making this jump to digital somehow a little bit easier. So I'll just go back to these takeaways and then say we have a few minutes, I guess, for questions.